Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Rebecca Martinez.
And I'm Willow Belden. Sawmills are reopening in Wyoming and Colorado after a decade of being shuttered. They're harvesting and processing trees that have been killed by beetle infestation. Still, many are suitable for lumber. Rebecca Martinez reports that this uptick in the timber business is helping with forest fire management.
On a densely wooded slope of Elk Mountain in Carbon County, a huge logging machine sets about clear-cutting a stand of lodgepole pines and fir trees. It has an enormous mechanical arm wielding a claw and a circular saw. In a few smooth motions, it slices through several trees a few stories high, gently lifts them, and places them in a tidy bunch. This device that fells and bunches trees is called a feller buncher.
The equipment that the loggers use is very expensive, and just the labor that goes into it. If it weren't for having the sawmills in the area, we wouldn't be able to do hardly any forest management.
Josh Van Vlack is with the Wyoming State Forestry Division. He says the area's new sawmill, Saratoga Forest Management, makes it possible to clear out hundreds of acres of beetle-killed wood. The company sells the wood in the form of 2x4s and wood chips, and the forestry division gets help clearing out swaths of dense forest. Van Vlack points out that half the forest is already dead.
The mountain pine beetle has attacked the lodgepole pine and the ponderosa pine at a pretty much landscape scale.
The region has seen serious wildfires spreading in recent years that have threatened cities and taken lives. Foresters blame poor management over the last century. Historically, extinguishing fires was the priority, which allowed forests to grow denser. Then, in reaction to overharvesting, environmental restrictions drastically limited timber sales. Brian Farabee with the U.S. Forest Service's Rocky Mountain region added that these factors have enabled a feeding frenzy among native bark beetles.
The host beetles have just taken advantage of a combination of climate change, drought, and the lack of vegetation treatment across the landscape and has really spread.
To make matters worse, competition from Canada and a weak domestic construction market forced many regional sawmills out of business in the early 2000s. This January, one of the biggest sawmills in the region came back to life. Clint George is one of the owners of Saratoga Forest Management. He says once you eliminate fire and harvesting,
what you end up with is densely spaced forests where the trees are competing for nutrients, and therefore they're susceptible to disease, they're susceptible to insects, they're susceptible to fires.
The rash of beetle kill and rapidly spreading wildfires were game changers for the timber industry. Last year, the Forest Service sold off nearly four times as much timber as it had in 2000. They're selling marketable timber to sawmills and hiring loggers to strategically cut down the less valuable but more dangerous stuff. Sawmills benefit because beetle-killed wood is just as strong as regular wood. And Saratoga's Clint George says federal, state, and private forest managers are happy because thinning wooded areas can also improve forest health, much like fire did naturally.
And so we can go out into the forest, and when we harvest, it opens up the forest floor. The seeds now that are dropped during the process, the pine cones open up, the seeds start to regenerate, and you have a regeneration of the forest.
Saratoga Forest Management is processing about 25 million feet of logs per year. Owners say that if more timber becomes available, the mill could handle three times that much, removing even more fuel from the regional forests. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Martinez.
One of the main things that threatens sage-grouse is human development and fragmentation of their habitat. But another big worry is West Nile virus. The disease is carried by mosquitoes, and researchers are now testing a new method for keeping mosquitoes in check. We're joined now by Brad Fady, who's leading the project. He says West Nile virus is a major concern for sage-grouse.
We could be one bad year away, one bad West Nile outbreak year away from many local extirpations for sage-grouse in the region. So the idea is how can we control mosquito production in the region in the hopes that it has this effect of reducing the risk of West Nile transmission to sage-grouse.
And so you are trying to, you're hoping to control mosquitoes with fish.
That's the idea. So standard approach is you can use a larvicide to spray to kill the mosquito larva, but There's been past work that has shown, particularly in urban areas and in controlled situations, that fathead minnows really love to eat mosquito larvae. And so what they've done in several urban areas is drainages and these sorts of things, they'll dump the fish in, and the fish tend to consume a significant number of the mosquito larvae. And we thought, why not try that in northeast Wyoming? We've chosen a bunch of sites, and we've introduced some fathead minnows into some of these stock ponds to monitor how good they are at controlling mosquito larvae production.
So why would it be better to use flathead minnows than to use larvicides?
There's a number of benefits here. One of them is that, you know, the hope is if we can establish self-sustaining populations of fathead minnows from a very practical standpoint, that would mean you don't have to fly and spray every single year. In some of these larger ponds, we're optimistic that we'll be able to actually introduce the fish and establish breeding populations. And so what that does is that saves you a lot of time and effort. Part of the research that we're doing is we're hoping to conduct an economic analysis when we're done and look at, okay, what are the trade-offs between spending money on larvicide and spraying versus introducing the fathead minnows. There's potential side effects of spraying larvicide, and obviously there's potential side effects of using fathead minnows, but we're hoping that with the fathead minnows, the potential side effects will be much lower.
Is there any concern about introducing lots of new fish to bodies of water?
Yeah, and that's a great question, and we've considered this from multiple angles. The ponds that we're introducing these fish to are all isolated. None of our experimental ponds are connected to other ponds by water flow, so fish moving from one area to the other, is the potential for that is very, very low. And these fathead minnows are used as a bait fish all throughout Wyoming. We're a little bit beyond the natural range of the minnows, but they are used as a common bait fish throughout the state. We suspect it might change the ecosystem structure in some ways, but we're hoping that it'll all be benefit ways that benefit both that system and benefiting us by helping control the mosquito larvae.
How does this fit into sort of the broad, I mean, obviously there are lots of efforts going on to protect sage grouse in different ways. I guess how big a part of that is would this be?
You know, we hope it's going to become a real significant part, particularly for those populations at low to mid elevation. Like I said, there's been some fabulous work that's been done that shows that this is a very, very serious threat to sage grouse. And there's been a lot of work on many of the other threats and how to mitigate those threats, and I think we're making positive choices in a lot of cases in order to try to mitigate these impacts on sage grouse. West Nile virus is this big wild card, and we need to approach it somehow. And I think this project, if we can show under what conditions is this sort of treatment successful. You know, we have a variation in the number of ponds that we're using and in the structure of those ponds and the water quality of those ponds and the morphology of those ponds. The idea is we want to be able to provide people with some sort of guidance and guidelines and be able to say, if you have this type of pond, there's a high probability that you can establish self-sustaining populations and they will have this sort of impact on mosquito production.
So is the goal here that the minnows would be more effective than larvicides, or simply that they would be better for the environment and more self-sustaining so you wouldn't have to deal with this every year?
Yeah, the goal is to see if it's a viable alternative. I believe that in some cases larvicide is probably going to be necessary, but the minnow option is one that has worked elsewhere. And if we can make it work here, we're really hoping that we'd actually be able to maintain self-sustaining populations. And if that were the case, you can imagine the trickle-down effect of stocking a pond. One, it's a minimal financial outlay, and it's done once. And if we can establish self-sustaining populations, then you know you don't have to go back and revisit it. There's not this constant investment of the finances into the larvicide itself, the fuel in order to deliver that larvicide and apply it to the landscape. All of that could be mitigated and potentially avoided in some cases.
All right, Brad, thanks so much.
Thank you, Willow. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about the project.
When we come back, we'll hear about potential challenges the trona industry could face in Sweetwater County, and we'll look at a program that's meant to help Albany County authorities learn how to respond to incidents like the Columbine and Virginia Tech massacres. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Rebecca Martinez. Trona mining is a widely forgotten part of the state's extraction industries, but in Sweetwater County, it's a big deal. Just west of Green River, there's a hidden labyrinth of tunnels far below I-80, and the industry is a major part of the county's economy. But some worry that environmental issues could be a major burden for trona mining. Amanda LeClaire has more.
You probably use a product made with trona nearly every day. Soda ash, which is made from trona, is a vital ingredient in the production of glass, from bottles to window panes to light bulbs, even the screen on your smartphone. You likely also have it in your kitchen in the form of baking soda. This area of the Green River Basin happens to be the world's biggest and purest deposit of trona, and a company called FMC has been mining here since the 1950s.
Right now we're looking at, we're coming off the landing, and you can look to see ahead of us.
Fred Von Ahrens is the manufacturing director for FMC's Green River operation. He's allowed me to take a tour of the underground mining operation with a guide. We're going more than 1,500 feet below ground to see one of the largest trona mines in the nation. It's warm and humid down here, and seemingly endless tunnels continue as far as the eye can see. Large stalactites made of trona hang from overhead, which immediately turn into powder when touched. There's white trona dust everywhere. In fact, Von Ahrens says there's so much trona here that the company is planning to continue mining operations well into the next century.
The trona is a natural resource that we have over 75 years of mine reserves just in hard rock mining and much more beyond that. We're going to be in this community for a long, long time to come.
Trona is one of Sweetwater County's most stable sources of jobs and revenue, and Von Ahrens says the market is expected to grow steadily over the next few years. The trona industry also rarely experiences severe economic ups and downs, like you get in oil, gas, and coal mining. So it's a significant cornerstone of Sweetwater's economy. Wally Johnson is the chairman of the Board of Commissioners in Sweetwater County. He says that when the trona mines began to open more than 60 years ago, the county badly needed a new industry.
Fortunately, the trona industry came on stream just as the coal mines, the underground coal mines, were phasing out. So it was very opportune that the trona was being developed at the appropriate time in the early 50s.
But he says the industry faces two potential environmental hurdles in the near future. One is that sage-grouse are being considered for the endangered species list.
If the sage-grouse gets listed as an endangered species, with roughly 38% of Sweetwater County as core habitat, that would have a very detrimental effect, I believe, on the potential of developing the minerals that exist in those areas.
That's because trona mining operations can disturb prime sage-grouse habitat. The second potential hurdle that the industry is facing has to do with air quality. The Environmental Protection Agency has proposed a regional haze management plan to address visibility issues. It would require local utilities to spend more than $1 billion to retrofit pollution control devices on coal-fired power plants. That might not affect trona mining right away, but Johnson says he's worried this could be the first step toward additional requirements that would affect the industry. He adds that he believes the extraction industries, including trona, are partially responsible for the air pollution that's decreasing visibility. But he says there's a much bigger cause that the EPA is ignoring: wildfires. Steve Dietrich is the DEQ's Air Quality Division Administrator. His department has been taking the lead on talks between the state and the EPA.
Regional haze is not a health-based program. It's all about visibility in Class 1 areas. One of the bigger areas that we concentrated on is that the bigger contributors to regional haze, especially in western states and certainly in Wyoming, is from wildfires.
Still, state officials say they expect the debate over haze management to continue for the foreseeable future. Back at the Green River Mine, Von Ahrens explains that FMC is careful to address the environmental issues being created by trona mining, like building wildlife-friendly fences for nesting sage-grouse. He says his biggest concern is more immediate.
Bringing talent in to help us grow the business is really, right now, my number one challenge.
And with 7.6 unemployment nationwide, that's good news for job seekers. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Amanda LeClaire in Rock Springs.
We're joined now by Kurt Johnson. He lives in Wilson and is the author of a new field guide for Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks. Johnson says that while there were already a lot of field guides for those parks, he felt he could still add something.
I just have always been a student of field guides. I've always loved field guides and just thought that there was a niche to create a field guide that was a field guide to a little bit of everything. So this is a field guide that ranges from waterfalls to geysers to insects to birds and mammals and tracks and even the night sky. So that's kind of what's different about it, is that it covers a wide range of topics.
So now I have to ask, what is the process of researching a field guide like this like? Is this a lot of exploring out in the parks, or is this a lot of more sort of desk research?
It's a lot of both. I mean, I work as a professional naturalist guiding for Spring Creek Ranch here in Jackson Hole. So I'm in the parks just about every day, sharing the natural world with visitors and locals who are just interested in getting to know the parks more. So, you know, I've learned a lot from a wide variety of books and resources and literature, but I feel like I've learned just as much by, you know, observing, personally observing the animals, and they've taught me as much as any book ever could.
So obviously a lot of visitors who go to Yellowstone or Grand Teton are looking for bears or moose or elk, you know, the sort of the large charismatic animals. But what are some of the sort of more hidden gems, whether it's plants or animals or even natural features that people might not be looking for, but that really might merit a closer look?
Well, I think you're right. I think that, you know, maybe on your first visit to this region, you might have grizzly bear and moose on your list of things to see and experience. But I think as we spend more time in a place, then, you know, the smaller things become much more interesting. You know, things like insects. You know, insects are something that you can observe and study no matter where you are. And this is as good of a place as any. So I think that, you know, I think when people start paying attention to things like aquatic invertebrates, you know, the stories behind the aquatic invertebrates and the butterflies and even the beetles, you know, those are just as interesting in many ways as the natural history of a bear or something like a moose.
Was there anything that surprised you in researching this guide?
There were a lot of surprises, I would say. I think probably one of the greatest surprises was how there was not a lot of information on certain subjects. Like, for example, one of the shortest sections in the field guide is the section on mushrooms. But it was also one of the more difficult to create because there wasn't a whole lot of information, and there's not a lot of people who actually have an expertise in mushrooms in this area. So that required a fair bit of research and going beyond this ecosystem for assistance in getting to know the mushrooms of this area.
So why these two parks? Why were these the places that you wanted to focus on for your field guide?
Because I spend so much time in them. I mean, I truly love these parks, and they're my backyard. And also, it's always worth noting when you're talking about Yellowstone, simply that it's, you know, an intact ecosystem in that, you know, it has the same predators, the same regime of animals and plants that you would have found here 300, 400 years ago. And that's a very rare characteristic to this area.
Kurt Johnson is the author of a new field guide on Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks. Thanks so much, Kurt.
It was great talking to you.
Ever since the 1999 shootings at Columbine High School in Colorado, law enforcement agencies across Wyoming have been preparing for how they might handle an active shooter situation. This summer, authorities from agencies across Albany County gathered in Laramie for some high-intensity training together. Rebecca Martinez reports.
Come on, with your hands up.
Two officers cautiously stalk into a small auditorium in the University of Wyoming's classroom building. Their handguns are aimed at a man in a baseball cap near the chalkboard. He's holding a gun to a young woman's back.
Get back or I'm a killer! Get back!
Call me,
get
please.
Back! Get back or I'm a killer!
The shootout between the officers and the designated bad guy did incapacitate the gunman, but only after a wax bullet grazed the arm of the hostage. Everyone involved with the drill works for a law enforcement agency in Albany County. The officers are debriefed after each exercise.
Yeah, you want them down here because yeah. Your shot is her, not me.
Then the bad guy and the hostage resume their places and a new pair of officers enters the room.
Our goal here today is to provide countywide training to all of our law enforcement first responders in the event that they should encounter an active shooter situation.
That's Detective Ryan Gertis of the Laramie Police Department. Laramie PD and the University of Wyoming Police Department co-hosted 3 days of active shooter training. An active shooter is someone who is killing or trying to kill people in a confined and populated area. Most examples in recent years have happened in schools, but the theater shooting in Aurora, Colorado is another example.
An active shooter situation is not necessarily always a shooting. It could potentially involve somebody who is wielding a knife or a sword. It could involve explosives, anything like that.
Natrona County authorities applied their active shooter training at Casper College in November when a young man killed a computer science instructor with a bow and arrow and then stabbed himself. University of Wyoming Police Chief Mike Samp organized and oversaw the training drill on UW's campus. Instructors combined techniques from two schools of tactical thought, from both the National Tactical Officers Association and the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. Samp and his Laramie PD counterparts invited a number of local agencies to train, including the Albany County Sheriff's Office, Wyoming Highway Patrol, the Department of Game and Fish, and Wyoming State Parks.
You know, we live in a very rural environment here in Laramie, and we do have limited resources. And if a situation were to occur, whether it's on campus or elsewhere in the community or you're out in the county, it may be a single individual from several different agencies respond, and this will give us the means to be able to have a collaborative effort on that response.
The UW Police Department hopes to coordinate a collaborative training like this each year. They also offer active shooter response training to the rest of the campus community. Vice President for Student Affairs, Sarah Axelson, says these kinds of trainings are among the factors that make UW students feel safe. She says feeling prepared allows students to focus on learning.
You don't want a false sense of safety or a false sense of fear. I think you have to be educated, have your muscle memory in place, have enough communication around safety that people can live and work in an environment where they feel like day in and day out they can get their work done and not be preoccupied that they're in fear.
Back in the classroom building, a game warden stands in the doorway, takes aim at the gunman, and shoots the bad guy clean behind the ear.
All right, yeah, that was a good shot.
During the debrief, instructors praised the warden's marksmanship, but urged him to take more caution when engaging a gunman with a hostage. They say Albany County authorities are doing good work, and they'd rather smooth out the kinks in training before they take on this kind of heat in the field. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Martinez.
When we come back, we'll hear from several Japanese Americans who were incarcerated at the Heart Mountain Relocation Center near Cody during World War II. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Rebecca Martinez.
And I'm Willow Belden. It's time now for the first installment in our occasional series, Wyoming Stories. This is a project where we record the memories and stories of Wyoming residents or people with some connection to Wyoming.
We're going to start with three Japanese Americans who were incarcerated at the Heart Mountain Relocation Center near Cody. Heart Mountain was one of 10 internment camps where Japanese Americans were confined during World War II. There's now a museum on the site, and each year the Heart Mountain Foundation hosts an annual pilgrimage. During this year's pilgrimage, Willow Belden sat down with several former internees and produced this piece.
My name is Sam Mihara. I was born in San Francisco in 1933, and I was 9 years old when Pearl Harbor took place, and the government decided to then remove anyone of Japanese ancestry from the West Coast and place them in camps. The one that our family went to was here at Heart Mountain in Wyoming. We weren't told much at all. What we saw was a printed sign in front of our homes, lamp posts or walls, the sign basically saying that all persons of Japanese ancestry will move. And they put us on trains, some 600, 700 people per train, And we got on these trains and rode for 3 days and nights, not knowing where we were going. We just stayed on the train until it finally wound up here in northern Wyoming. Our Heart Mountain guards met us, and we were placed on the backs of army trucks. And then the truck proceeded to take us through the main gate and into our designated barrack inside the Heart Mountain camp. Each barrack had 6 rooms. 4 of us were inside one room. There was a pot-bellied stove fired by coal in one corner. There were army cots, and we went to a common toilet and washroom area in the middle of the block. So that was kind of difficult in the wintertime, having to go out in a terrible Wyoming winter. That winter, it got down to 28 degrees below zero, and the wind was howling at like 50 miles an hour. That was very, very difficult. And we were wearing California clothing. The government did not tell us where we were going. We had a mess hall, one per every half a block. Everybody in general had bad food at the start, potatoes and bread. Once in a while, we would have something like a mutton or lamb. So we grew our own vegetables. They created farms and... We had a chicken farm, and we had a pig farm, and so our diet got better within about a year. It took a year for the farms to get established. I was in grammar school, and it was quite difficult at the outset. There were complaints from the local people who were saying that new schools should not be built for the camp residents because the locals don't have new schools. Why should the camp residents have new schools? And so I wound up going into grammar schools in barracks. There was no furniture. We sat on the floor at the start. There were very few books. There were not enough certified teachers, and the parents insisted on certification because they wanted the kids to continue on to college. So the government hired several teachers, white teachers from around the country. And they lived in the camp. That was interesting. They had their own barracks, kind of a special set of barracks for people who lived and worked from the outside. No one escaped as such because we're in the middle of nowhere, and everybody in the area knew who we were by looking at us. And after some time, the camp allowed people, knowing that we were not going to run away, they had day passes. And I remember one day, we had a day pass, and so my dad took my brother and I and my mother to Cody. Unfortunately, many businesses did not want us, and there were signs that said we would not be allowed in, and that was a very difficult part of living there, knowing the people did not want us there. The bottom line of all of this is it should not have happened. We were guaranteed our civil rights by the Constitution, and the system failed.
My name is Shigeru Yabu. I was born in San Francisco, California. Nobody told us we were going to Wyoming. We got on the train, and finally, late one evening, we landed up in Heart Mountain. The very next day, my friend, Akira Yoshimura, comes over, and let's go exploring. So nearby, there was a lot of little sand dunes, and we saw a little hole. And so we got one of the sagebrushes, and it got a branch and poked it. And out came a bug about this big. And he said, hey, you know, that will make a good pet. Not having any brothers, having pet was very important. Well, later on, we found out it was a scorpion. So we put it back, towards the hole and says goodbye. One time, there was our next-door neighbor, a fellow by the name of Ken Sewell. He was known as the expert marksmanship with slingshots. So one of the kids said, there's a magpie nest way up high. Let's see if we could hit it. And next thing you know, you could see the nest wobbling. It hit the ground, it rolled. Little did we know that there was a magpie baby bird in there. One of the little older boys said, do you know, that bird's going to die. I said, how do you know? Because the mother bird cannot lift the magpie baby bird up to another nest. I says, that bird's going to live. It's going to be my bird, like a brother. I still don't know whether it was a male or female, but I called it Maggie. So became great friends. When I went to school, I would say, hello, Maggie. When I came home, I say, hello, Maggie. When I went to play with my friends, I would say, instead of saying goodbye, I say, hello, Maggie. One day, as I was just about ready to go up the stair, I said, hello, Maggie. And I heard, hello, Maggie. And I looked, thinking somebody's playing a trick with me. And nobody's around. So I went in front of the cage. I looked at that bird, eye to eye, and I said, hello, Maggie. And that bird said, hello, Maggie. Well, next thing you know, it picked up other words. Come on, Maggie. And my mother used to say, what you doing? And the bird would say, what you doing? It learned to whistle. And that bird could laugh. It mimicked you exactly the way you laugh. It was August the 14th, 1945. The sirens went off for the first time. We were playing basketball outside. And we knew the war ended. And Maggie and I would talk about, someday we're going to go to San Francisco. And probably you won't be able to live with us, but I'm going to donate you to the San Francisco Zoo. Then I could come and visit you each weekend. And middle of October, Maggie was on the bottom of the cage, eyes flickering. So Maggie slept under my bed. I got up early in the morning, and she was hard as a rock. I dug a hole. Her favorite toys went in burial. Gave my T-shirt to Maggie. Buried it. Made a cross. I was the only one there. And it was a sad moment. Maggie did not want to leave Wyoming nor Heart Mountain.
I'm Takashi Hoshizaki, and from Los Angeles. I was 16 years old when all of this happened. We finally ended up in Heart Mountain. Well, a typical day for me was basically working in the mess hall. I had the afternoons free, so then that was the time that I took classes to finish my high school degree. But eventually I got my draft notice, and I didn't report it. I said, no, I'm not going. Maybe a week or so later, I don't know who, the marshal, the FBI, so on, came and picked me up and began questioning me. And so I responded truthfully. And so then after that, I was just hauled around to Cody County Jail. And eventually, I ended up in Casper, Wyoming, in their jail. Later on, I find out that here there were 63 of us. We had filled up most of the county jails in the state of Wyoming. And when the trial started in Cheyenne, they took us all down there, and so that we were jammed into the Cheyenne. I think that was a federal court, federal jail. some of us ended up sleeping on the floor, and we just, it was kind of a nightmare there. We were sentenced to 3 years, went to McNeil Island, which is in the Puget Sound. As a general rule, after you serve one-third of your sentence, then you get a parole hearing. And we did not get that parole hearing. And the reason we found out that the WRA director had written a letter to the prison authorities to keep us in as long as they could, because they were afraid that the recruitment for the Army would be disrupted. We served just 2 years. We got out. And then a year or so later, Harry Truman was in office. And then he gave us a Christmas pardon to all the draft resistors. And so we ended up with nothing on our records on that. I then went to the local college, that was the Los Angeles City College, 2 years there, and then went to UCLA, got my bachelor's degree in science, and then while I was working for my master's degree, I get my second draft notice. So here I am, you know, we're all out, as we were saying, that release us, and then we would go into the Army. Well, family was out, I was now released, I had my full citizenship rights and so forth. So I was able to finish my master's. Then I was drafted and then went into the Army. So I think I served double duty. So Heart Mountain was really the only camp that had an organized resistance. And I think as time goes on, Heart Mountain will be known just for the resistance. And so it's going to be interesting 25 years from now what the exhibits and what the people will be saying.
That was Sam Mihara, Shigeru Yabu, and Takashi Hoshizaki. All three were interned at the Heart Mountain Relocation Center near Cody during World War II. Hoshizaki later served in the U.S. Army Medical Corps and eventually became a research scientist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Shigeru Yabu served in the Navy and later wrote a children's book about his magpie called Hello Maggie. Sam Mihara became a rocket scientist with Boeing and later started his own high-tech consulting firm. He regularly travels around the country speaking about his experiences at Heart Mountain. You can hear additional stories on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
When we come back, we'll talk with a man who's traveling from Mexico to Canada, mostly on foot, to promote an international wildlife corridor. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Rebecca Martinez.
And I'm Willow Belden. John Davis is a conservationist and co-founder of the Wildlands Network Conservation Organization. He's currently on a 5,000-mile international route from Mexico through the western U.S. and up to Canada, mostly on foot. He's working with various environmental groups as he makes his way across North America. The idea is to promote an international continuous area where wildlife can move freely. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhoroff caught up with Davis as he made his way across the Red Desert. He started off explaining his mission.
We are promoting a great vision of a Western Wildway, a wildlife corridor that would span the Rocky Mountains and include well-conserved private and public lands and allow the full range of native species to roam as they need to, and also provide opportunities for outdoor recreation.
So why is it so important for wildlife to be able to roam such a large, unbroken corridor? Like, if the wolf population in Yellowstone is managed such that the park is roomy enough for them, why do they need to move outside of it?
Animals need to roam widely for several key reasons. One, they need to travel to find mates quite often. They sometimes have to move long distances to find adequate food and cover. Sometimes they need to move with climate change, and that's especially a concern these days as we overheat the globe. Many animals will need to be able to move northward or upward to track their climate envelopes. And it's important that animals be able to intermix. If animals are not intermixing, then genetic inbreeding happens and populations suffer genetic loss and loss of genetic diversity. So there are a whole host of reasons why animals need to be able to roam widely. And unfortunately, we've put many roads and towns and cities and agricultural operations in the way of animal movement. And so what we're proposing with Trek West is that we make room for wildlife and put wildlife crossings on our roads and use wildlife-friendly farming and forestry techniques so that animals can resume their ancient travel ways.
In Wyoming specifically, what are the animals that you're trying to focus on?
Well, wolves are here, as you know, up in Yellowstone Park, and I believe, and most of my colleagues involved in Trek West believe, that wolves should be welcomed in larger areas of the state. They play critical regulatory roles in keeping deer and elk numbers in check. They lead to healthier forests, basically. Cougars are also there. Again, this is an important top predator that helps keep prey numbers in balance. And then there are a whole host of other animals that need to be able to move widely, from eagles to trout to members of the weasel family and even some reptiles and fish and so forth.
In your trek so far, which has started in Mexico, what are some of the successes you've seen and areas that you feel most acutely need the sort of attention you're trying to bring?
I began the journey in Sonora, northern Mexico, in a place called the Northern Jaguar Reserve, a 50,000-acre piece of wildland protected through the generosity of private donors, wildlands philanthropists, you might call them, who pieced together these 50,000 acres as wildlife habitat for the four native cat species, bobcat, ocelot, puma or cougar, and jaguar. And I was fortunate enough while I was hiking and horseback riding through the Northern Jaguar Reserve to see tracks of all four of these great cats. Getting a little farther into the United States, along Route 260, which bisects the Mogollon Rim in Arizona, about 20 wildlife crossings have been put in, largely for elk. And they have saved many, many lives, probably human as well as elk lives. And the problem of cars hitting elk has been reduced by more than 90%. So these wildlife crossings are more than paying for themselves very quickly because of reduced collisions between people and wildlife. And then nearer home, for those of you fortunate enough to live in Wyoming, I think the reintroduction of the wolf to Yellowstone Park is one of the great conservation success stories of recent years. It's been Yellowstone is a healthier ecosystem because of the return of the wolf.
What are some areas that left you with perhaps a less optimistic impression?
Well, as everybody in Wyoming knows, there's a spate of energy development that's particularly associated with oil and gas. And that's problematic. It means fragmenting wildlife habitats with roads, power lines and oil rigs, and it means a great deal of truck traffic. It means a lot of dust in the air. It means air and water pollution. I think most of us agree we need to become more energy independent. I would strongly prefer to see energy independence achieved through conservation rather than escalated exploitation of oil and gas resources. And Wyoming is perhaps the hardest hit state in the country for extraction of fossil fuels, and it's hard to go long distances in the state without seeing oil rigs and so forth. So that's from the standpoint of wildlife conservation, this rapid rate of fossil fuel extraction is very problematic, very fragmenting of the habitats that wildlife need.
I wonder, since you started in Mexico and are going to end in Canada, have you seen a difference in how these countries approach wildlife conservation?
Yes. Conservation in any of the three countries necessarily involves good stewardship of private lands as well as strong conservation on public lands, but there's not much public land in Mexico. So really, if you want to conserve wildlife habitat, if you want to restore missing animal and plant species in Mexico, you have to work closely with landowners and find good incentives for them to be careful stewards of the land. So, you know, we have a big advantage in the American West because of the large public land base. That makes it easier to conserve land for wildlife. It makes it easier to reconnect or keep connected wild lands so that animals can move. It's a bit more of a challenge in Mexico because of the lack of public land.
So how do you propose working in Mexico where there's less public land and you have to work with more people? Or in a place like Wyoming where a lot of the state really depends on the energy development, how do you propose working in those situations to accomplish what you're trying to do?
It's very important to find good incentives, including financial incentives, to reward landowners for good, careful land stewardship. And groups like Naturalia and the Northern Jaguar Project and Cueca Los Ojos in Mexico are looking for those sorts of incentives with some success. And back to that example of the Northern Jaguar Project, one of the things that that group is doing is literally paying the ranchers around the reserve for photographs rather than carcasses of the cats, the four native cats. So if a rancher who 10 years ago might have shot a puma when he saw it instead gets a photograph of the puma, he'll actually be paid for that photograph. That's an example of a way of rewarding a private landowner for being kind to wildlife rather than killing wildlife.
Thank you for taking some time to talk with me.
Thank you very much for your interest, and best of luck with your show.
After the Red Desert, Davis is heading to the Jonah Field, Bridger-Teton National Forest, Yellowstone, and then up to Canada.
Laramie residents have been noticing more rabbits than usual in town this year. Some experts say it's because there are fewer predators, but others aren't so sure. Wyoming Public Radio's Chelsea Biondalillo reports.
Melissa Gelwicks has had a backyard garden next to Undine Park for about 7 years. She grows everything from squashes and herbs to cabbages, beets, and greens. She's used to rabbits frequenting her garden, but this year there seem to be more of them.
In our yard and our neighbors' yards on either side of us, actually, you can look out at most times of the day and see one or two, or sometimes we've seen four rabbits right around our house.
The rabbits not only dig holes in the yard, they also try to eat her vegetables.
Once the seeds germinate, the critters come in droves, and we usually lose a batch or two to bunnies and squirrels before I get smart enough to put the netting on. And if you look over at the greens bed and then the bed with the sugar peas and the beets, you'll see that there's some black netting.
The netting goes over the beds, and she and her husband have also wrapped the garden's fence perimeter with chicken wire. This year, after early losses, he buried the chicken wire several inches below the grass line to prevent the rabbits from getting in underneath it. Melissa thinks there are more rabbits than last year, but it's hard to know for sure.
We don't really take a count, but it's a possibility. I can say that observationally, as I go around town, we have a lot of rabbits.
That's Steve Amron of Laramie's Animal Control, and he says that the rabbit population naturally fluctuates, but he thinks this year is a little different.
Last year we did have the fox population in this area was pretty badly decimated by mange. So, they are one of their chief predators. So with the predator population being down, that could certainly contribute to a population.
Donald O'Toole is a pathologist at the State Veterinary Laboratory. He's been researching the local increase in mange, a sometimes fatal disease caused by a skin parasite that occurs in many of Wyoming's predators.
We see it on a regular basis in coyotes. We see it in foxes, we see it in wolves. And it goes in cycles. It is, from a wildlife biologist standpoint, one of the diseases that controls the population. And it can cause a population increase in their natural prey species, including rabbits.
But not everyone believes that mange is to blame. Grant Frost, a wildlife biologist with Game and Fish in Cheyenne, says their rabbit numbers are up too. But foxes aren't the only reason.
They tend to cycle, go up and down quite a bit over the course of about 10 years or so.
Frost says that while fewer foxes are good for rabbits, there would probably be more rabbits either way. He also says that other predators, such as hawks and owls, will fill in for any missing foxes over time and lower the rabbit numbers.
The conditions that create these cycles are difficult to predict, but they do just seem to happen naturally, whether it's drought or a really good moisture year. It's just hard to tell when these, specifically which year is going to be an increase or a decrease. Rabbits are just part of the world we live in.
So, whether or not mange is to blame for this year's abundance of rabbits remains an open question. But what every expert agrees on is that the numbers will eventually drop back down. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Chelsea Biondalillo.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates and less important information, you can follow us all on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.